Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for words and their stories and people in America, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is Sunday. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Anna Mateo. On today's As It Is, we bring you a story about efforts to save endangered animals by killing them.
Some Asian countries are fighting to contain the illegal ivory trade and the killing of elephants by illegal hunters known as poachers. However, in South Africa, it's a different story. Big game hunting, hunting elephants, rhinos, lions, and other large animals, is a big tourist industry.
But many people object to this blood sport. Some argue that hunting big game animals creates income needed to save the country's wild population.
Big game hunting is very controversial. It also is called trophy hunting. Trophy and controversial may be new words for some of our listeners as well. So, listen for them in Anna's adaptation of this story about big game hunting.
In many sports, when you win or do well, you get a trophy. This trophy could be a medal, as in the Olympics, or it could be a cup or small statue. In hunting, especially big game hunting, the trophies are part of the animal that is killed. In their homes, hunters may show the skins, heads, and horns of the animals they kill. Trophy hunting for big game is a much disputed or controversial issue. It is also an emotional issue. A 19-year-old college student from the American state of Texas started an online debate recently. The controversy began when she posted pictures of herself with African wildlife she had hunted legally on a trip to South Africa. It is legal in some African countries to hunt big game. The business brings in a lot of money. A 10-day elephant package could cost $36,000. Hunting a rhinoceros can cost $100,000. The International Fund for Animal Welfare has strong words against what it calls the needless killing of endangered species for trophies. The organization says big game hunting is not sustainable, meaning it cannot be supported over a long period of time. The group also says it provides only short-term economic gains, hurts the area's environmental balance, and is morally wrong. But not all conservationists agree. Some argue trophy hunting may be helping Africa's wildlife. Professor John Hanks is the former head of the World Wide Fund for Nature in South Africa. He says tourism and donations do not provide the billions of dollars needed.
I think trophy hunting in South Africa is really absolutely essential if we're going to look for a long-term future for rhinos in the whole of Africa. And there's hardly a single country anywhere that can afford to run its national parks as they should be run. Here we are in South Africa, one of the richest countries in the continent. Kruger Park has 1 million visitors a year, and they still cannot afford to defend the rhinos.
The hunting industry in South Africa brings in more than $744 million each year. The industry employs about 70,000 people. And about 9,000 trophy hunters travel to South Africa every year. 90% of them come from the United States. In 2012, foreign hunters spent $115 million in South Africa. Trophy hunting is the most profitable form of commercial land use in the country. Herman Meyerdrix is the president of the Professional Hunters Association of South Africa. He argues that legal hunting is important to wildlife protection.
The only way that there will be an incentive for those landowners to protect and keep on investing in rhino and protecting these rhino is if they have an economic value. They can only have an economic value if there is an end user who's willing to pay for that, and that is the trophy hunter.
In South Africa, rhino poaching has become a crisis. Many people say hunting is leading to the disappearance of this endangered species. Mr. Meyerdrix argues that hunters would not be given permits or permission to hunt if the animals were truly under threat. He says that the number of animals hunted represents a small part of the total number of animals available. An international body called CITES controls the number of animals that hunters may kill. But critics say the system is weak because individual governments are responsible for confirming that hunting limits are observed. Susie Offord is the deputy director of the group Save the Rhino. She argues that trophy hunting could be a useful tool in protecting the rhino population if it is supervised correctly.
In an ideal world, rhinos wouldn't be under the extreme pressure that they are facing today, and there wouldn't be any need for trophy hunting. But the reality is that rhino conservation is incredibly expensive.
Not every country in Africa permits trophy hunting. Kenya has had a policy against it for a long time. The Kenyan government banned the sport in 1977, describing it as a barbaric part of its colonial past. Criminals presenting themselves as legal hunters have also become involved in trophy hunting. They use the business to illegally trade horns. They sell these animal parts for high prices on black markets in countries such as Vietnam and Thailand. South African officials say that since 2009, false hunters exported about 300 rhino horns illegally. Because of this, South Africa has stopped giving hunting permits to citizens from the Czech Republic and Vietnam. Conservationists argue that governments need to do more to fight the illegal hunting of big game and enforce hunting regulations. Much of the public is likely to continue to disapprove of trophy hunting as more elephants, rhinos, and lions are killed for sport. But for some environmentalists, the issue is not so clear-cut or easy to understand. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. For more details on this topic, go to our website at learningenglish.voanews.com.
There you will find an online quiz, as well as more examples of how to use some of the words you heard in this story.
Words and Their Stories is next, followed by People in America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
VOA special English program, Words and Their Stories.
Monkeys are very similar to us in many ways. Most have 10 fingers and 10 toes and brains much like ours. We enjoy watching them because they often act like us. In fact, Charles Darwin's theory of evolution says that monkeys and humans share a common ancestor. Songwriter William Gilbert, in the musical Princess Ida, wrote, "Darwinian man, though well-behaved, at best is only a monkey shaved." His words, sung to Sir Arthur Sullivan's music, make listeners smile. Well, monkeys make us smile, too, because they are creatures full of playful tricks. This is why many monkey expressions are about tricky people or playful acts. One of these expressions is monkey shines, meaning tricks or foolish acts. The meaning is clear if you have ever watched a group of monkeys playfully chasing each other, pulling tails, stealing food, doing tricks. So, when a teacher says to a group of students, "Stop those monkey shines right now," you know that the boys and girls are playing instead of studying. You might hear that same teacher warn a student not to monkey around with a valuable piece of equipment. You monkey around with something when you do not know what you are doing. You are touching or playing with something you should leave alone. Also, you can monkey around when you feel like doing something, but have no firm idea of what to do. For example, you tell your friend you are going to spend the day monkeying around with your car. Well, you do not have any job or goal in mind. It is just a way to pass the time. Monkey business usually means secret, maybe illegal activities. A news report may say there is monkey business involved in building the new airport, with some officials getting secret payments from builders. You may make a monkey out of someone when you make that person look foolish. Some people make a monkey out of themselves by acting foolish or silly. If one monkey has fun, imagine how much fun a barrel of monkeys can have. If your friend says he had more fun than a barrel of monkeys at your party, you know that he had a really good time. Monkey suits are common names for clothes or uniforms soldiers wear. In earlier years, in many American cities, you would find men playing musical hand organs on the street. Dancing to the music would be the man's small monkey, dressed in a tight-fitting, colorful jacket, similar to a military uniform. So, people began to call a military uniform a monkey suit.
This VOA special English program, Words and Their Stories, was written by Marilyn Cristiano. Morris Joyce was the narrator. I'm Shirley Griffith. I'm Phoebe Zimmerman.
And I'm Steve Ember with the VOA Special English Program, People in America. Today we tell about Irving Berlin. He wrote the words and music for some of the most popular songs of the 20th century.
Irving Berlin lived to be 101 years old. He died in 1989. During his long life, he wrote more than 1,000 songs. Many of his songs have become timeless additions to America's popular culture. Irving Berlin's music helped spread that popular culture throughout the world. Berlin was born in Russia, but he captured the feeling, the people, and the customs of his new country, and he put those ideas to music. Another composer, Jerome Kern, once said of Irving Berlin, "He has no place in American music. He is American music."
Most American children grow up hearing and singing some of Irving Berlin's songs. Two of the best known are linked to Christian religious holidays. They are White Christmas and Easter Parade. Many Americans think the perfect Christmas day on December 25th should be cold and snowy. Irving Berlin thought so too. He wrote White Christmas in 1939. It was sung in the movie Holiday Inn in 1942. White Christmas became one of the best-selling songs of all time. Here is Bing Crosby singing his famous version of White Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
Irving Berlin's song for the Easter holiday captures another American tradition. Easter Parade is about a tradition in New York City. There, on Easter morning, people walk up and down Fifth Avenue after church services to enjoy the spring weather. Women wear new hats and dresses. Berlin wrote the song for a musical play in 1933. It was the main song in the musical film Easter Parade in 1948. Here is Judy Garland singing Easter Parade.
In your Easter bonnet, with all the frills upon it, you'll be the grandest fellow in the Easter Parade. I'll be all in clover, and when they look us over, in the Easter Parade on the Avenue, Fifth Avenue, the photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure. Oh, I could write.
Irving Berlin was born Israel Balin in 1888 in the Russian village of Temun. He was the youngest of eight children. His family was Jewish. They fled Russia because of religious oppression. The Balin family came to America in 1893. They did not have much money. They moved into an area of New York City where many other poor Jewish immigrants had settled when they moved to the United States. Israel's father died when the boy was 8 years old. The young boy left his home to find work. First, he got a job helping a blind street singer. Then he began earning money by singing on the streets of New York. Later, he got a job singing while serving people their food in a restaurant. Israel taught himself to play the piano, but he could play only the black keys.
Soon Israel began writing his own songs. He never learned to read or write music. He wrote his songs by playing the notes with one finger on the piano. An assistant wrote down the notes on sheets of paper. When the songwriter's first song was published, his name was spelled wrong. Israel Balin had become I Berlin. Israel thought the name sounded more American, so he renamed himself Irving Berlin. Between 1912 and 1916, Irving Berlin wrote more than 180 songs. By the time he was in his late 20s, his songs were famous around the world.
Berlin became an American citizen in 1918. A few months later, he was ordered into military service. The United States was fighting in World War I. Berlin was asked to write songs for a musical about life in the military. He called the show Yip Yip Yapank. All of the performers in the show were soldiers. Many of the songs became popular. After he served in the Army, Berlin returned to New York. He formed his own music publishing company. He also established a theater for his musical shows near Broadway.
Irving Berlin loved America for giving a poor immigrant a chance to succeed. He expressed his thanks for this success in his songs. One of these songs is God Bless America. He wrote the song in 1918, but it did not become popular until Kate Smith sang it in 1939. She sang the song to celebrate Armistice Day, the anniversary of the end of World War I. Many people feel God Bless America is the unofficial national song of the United States. Berlin gave all money he earned from God Bless America to the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America. Here is Kate Smith singing God Bless America.
The United States entered World War II in 1941. Berlin agreed to write and produce a musical show called This Is the Army. It was a musical about life in the military. All the performers were soldiers. The show was performed in many cities across the United States. It helped increase support for America's part in the war. It earned $10 million for the Army Emergency Relief Fund. This Is the Army also was performed for American troops at military bases around the world. Irving Berlin appeared in most of these performances. He sang the song he had written earlier. The song is about what he had hated most about being in the Army. Here, Irving Berlin sings, "Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning."
I've been a soldier quite a while, and I would like to state the life is simply wonderful. The army food is great. I sleep with 97 others in a wooden hut. I love them all, they all love me, it's very lovely, but oh, how I hate to get up in the morning. Oh, how I'd love to remain in bed, for the hardest blow of all is to hear the bugler call. You gotta get up, you gotta get up, you gotta get up this morning. Someday I'm going to murder the bugle.
After the war, Berlin continued to write songs for movies and plays. He wrote songs for more than 15 movies from the 1930s to the 1950s. Many of the songs were used in movies starring the famous dancers Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Here is Fred Astaire singing a song that appeared in several movies, Puttin' on the Ritz.
Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air? High hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time. Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits. Putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper, come let's mix where Rockefeller.
Irving Berlin also wrote the music for 17 Broadway plays from the 1920s to 1950. His most successful Broadway musical was Annie Get Your Gun in 1946. Irving Berlin retired in 1962 after his last Broadway musical, Mr. President, failed. He died in 1989. But the songs that he gave America will be played and sung for many years to come.
This special English program was written by Shelley Gollist. It was produced by Lawan Davis. Our studio engineer was Suleiman Tarawali. I'm Phoebe Zimmerman.
And I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for another People in America program on The Voice of America.